first.
Could we have a moment of silence and the serenity prayer? Because I need that. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
You know, when we say that, I can't hear my voice. We sound like one voice. That's so cool. My name is Ellen Cassidy, and I'm an enthusiastic, boundlessly grateful Al-Anon. I've been going around talking for a while, back when I started decades ago, because my first meeting of Al-Anon was November 3rd of 1981, and I've been continuous, not consistent, but persistent these years. When I started going talking, 98% of the places I go are AA conferences. With Al-Anon participation. For which we are ever so grateful. You know. Just let us be with you any way we can. I love alcoholics. That's what got me here. I love them. I still do. And so God said, great, I can fix you up. So I would go out and talk at these places. And what would happen would be the Al-Anon speaker was usually breakfast or nap time. I don't care. I never did care. I have never counted heads in a room. Whoever's supposed to be here is going to be here. And if they're not here, they'll hear about it and they'll be sorry. That'll be all I need to do for the day, you know, is make them sorry. So, and the AA speakers never came. I never expected them. Nobody expected them. It was an Al-Anon meeting. We did not expect the AA speakers to show up. But I'm going to tell you, and what happened because of that, because I'm the only Al-Anon speaker, and I'm in BF Kansas. I got nobody there. You know, I was lost in rectangle states for a while. And the person that I connected with more than anything were the tapers. Because there would be the same taper there, or maybe someone who worked with him. They became my lifeline. I'd show up there. I remember I talked at a conference one time. It was not AA or Al-Anon, and I called my sponsor. It was like Adult Children or something. I don't remember exactly, honestly. I don't want to give them a bad name, but I told my sponsor I didn't believe I ought to go. It just didn't seem, it didn't feel right. And she said, you may be the only example that they see of program. It's nasty work, but someone has got to do it. So I went, and sure enough, I was the only program person on the dais. All of the rest of them were doctors and counselors. And God love him, one of our tapers, who knew me well at that point. And they made us all, every time somebody talked, every meal we ate, we all had to sit up front. Next to watching you eat as one of my least favorite things, watching me eat, knowing that I'm full. But anyway, the Friday night meeting, I could not get out of there. I'm pretty sure they could see the smoke coming out of the back of me. I could not get out of there fast enough. And I stopped by the table and I said, I'm leaving. I just want you to know I'm going in the morning. I cannot stay here. I cannot be part of this. And he said, whoa. Tell me what books you brought this time. And I had my Bill C. You're welcome. I had my Bill C. And he gave me a couple of pages. He said, I want you to go read those pages. And he said, after you read those pages, I want you to call your sponsor. And I read the pages and I called my sponsor. And I stayed. But I stayed because of his faithfulness, you know. And I know that's how I met Lee and John and consequently Hannah. They feel like family to me. I cannot tell you how grateful I am for them. And then what started happening was there would be one AA woman. I remember flying into Minneapolis with an AA woman one time. We'd been to some conference up in God knows where, North Dakota or something. And we were flying back into Minneapolis to come back to civilization. And we happened to sit together and we talked on the plane. And I was, I just wanted to listen to her. I just wanted to be close to her. I just wanted to hear. Because those women talk about things we don't talk about in Al-Anon. It's not good or bad. It's just different. And I'm a more person, just like you. I want more. I want more. And I wanted to be with them. I don't like girls either. Never did. Didn't have a lot in common with them except body parts. And that's not a lot to brag about. but I love those women. And when I get to my story, which I promise you I will, I had to cancel all my talks this last year from September on. And I canceled all till this weekend. Because I thought, I know where I need to be. I need to be with them. I need to be with you. I need to be with girls who are silly and loud and rude. Amanda puts up with such stuff up here, but then Amanda doesn't care. She just talks right over the top of you, by God. I'd be giving you my teacher voice. Eyes on me. So Polly and I have been together since the beginning of time. Her time and my time. We've been together because she got sober in my area. So, and I can't tell you anything she hadn't already told you. She is who she says she is. She is exactly that. I love you. Don't start. Okay. I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. I always want to explain that. It's not necessarily good news because explaining things is how I got to Al-Anon. I really thought if I could get you to listen long enough, I'd find the right word and then you'd understand. And you'd go, oh, why, you're right. It's my two favorite words. You're right. And what's happened is God is, you know, that's not what happened. That's never what happened. That's never what happened. What I ended up being, instead of being the leader out of the darkness for my family, which Ellen is a form of Helen, which means light. So I was pretty sure that was my job. I was going to lead them out of the darkness. I ended up being somebody's judge and somebody's juror and somebody's executioner. None of us were happy. None of us were happy. I ended up being, instead of the leader out of the light, I ended up being a walking, talking, squawking human bedevilment. Human bedevilment on feet with a mouth. But I was like, somebody said, it might have been Mari this morning, but I was a scream looking for a mouth. The scream was in, there was no way out. When I got to Al-Anon, I didn't want to be here. I never wanted to be here. I always wanted to be someplace else with somebody else doing something else. Because I know it's going to be better there. Wherever there is, it's got to be better. What I've learned in the last couple of years is there's no such place as there. You get over there, you're just here all over again. You take everything you had back there and just took it over here now. So that I had to give up that dream too. Somebody really wants in. Okay. Lock the doors. We're not letting them in. I've been in Al-Anon a little while, and I decided what I really wanted to be was alcoholic. Well, I had a couple of reasons for that. Number one, it was painfully obvious that alcoholic women had more fun than we did. And number two, apparently my husband preferred them. I am just reporting all I'm doing. I've learned today that the difference between being diseasy and being uncomfortable. When I am diseasy, I want a person, place, or thing to get a certain way, and then I'll be okay. But then there's uncomfortable. And when I'm uncomfortable, I'm in my own skin. I'm breathing my own air. Maybe I don't know what's happening in front of me. Maybe I don't know how it's going to go. Maybe I don't know how it's going to come out, which has always been such a problem for me, to not know how it's going to come out. Maybe that's why I'm uncomfortable. What I've learned in Al-Anon is I don't grow in my comfort zone. I only grow in my uncomfortable zone. So uncomfortable is not a bad place to be. It's sort of like a spiritual itch. It doesn't seem to go away for very long. I don't care how long you're here. It doesn't seem to go away for very long. And I'm not complaining. I'm glad. I was in a meeting the other day, and they were talking about being complacent in their program, and I could not remember a time when I felt complacent. Because life keeps happening. And every time life happens, I have two choices. I can either choose to pick up my program, to grab hold of my program, step in farther, step in deeper, do it with more heart this time than I've done it ever, or else I can start backing away. And I've seen that happen. I mean, that's why people leave, is because they started backing away. So anyway, that day I was diseasy. And when I'm diseasy, I pretty much have the same solution. I think if I change how it looks on the outside, I can change how it feels on the inside. All I had to do was look alcoholic. I came into Al-Anon in gorgeous North Dallas, and there is a look to alcoholic women in gorgeous North Dallas. I'm just saying. You can kind of see it on Katie. It's kind of gone south to Katie. I don't own those kind of clothes, girls. I don't own them. But the day I decided to be alcoholic, I was at a conference, and I had an AA woman friend there, and she loaned me her clothes. So I came out that afternoon in my alcoholic outfit. Skin-tight jeans and stiletto heels. Yeah, baby! Made a couple of discoveries in that little experiment. I don't like anything that controlled me like those pants. And Al-Anons are doomed to sensible shoes. We really are built for speed and not for looks. You love an alcoholic, you've got to be ready to go in a heartbeat. Or you could lose him. The place I decided to do that little experiment was at the Crested Butte Mountain Conference in Crested Butte, Colorado. You're here, my people. With 600 of my closest friends. And I not only, there were four people. Now, this is like 1984. And there were, I think, five people there that weekend who had between them 125 years of Al-Anon, which was a lot of Al-Anon in the mid-80s. Elsa Chamberlain was there. Marcy White was there. There were two others. Maybe it was just four of them. Two others in the Dallas area who'd had been in a long, long time. And I not only got to listen to their stories and sit in meetings with them, I got to visit with them one-on-one, but most importantly, I got to watch their interactions with their families. I finally knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. That's a question that's haunted me my whole life. What do you want to be? Well, I just know what I want to do. I'm not sure what I want to be. But I walked away from that conference knowing what I want to be. I want to be free. I want the freedom that's offered me in step three, the freedom to be who it is God would have me be. And I walked away from there so grateful that there was such a thing as Al-Anon, and somehow, some way, I had fallen into that. Now, when I came to Al-Anon, And I didn't have very many opinions. I either had yours or the opposite of yours, depending on what I wanted you to do. And then I developed very strong opinions. It's like the pendulum swings all the way to the other side. And the only time you see balance is when you're swinging through it, you know. But it kind of evens. It gets a little evener after a while until it goes crazy again. Anyway, I had very strong opinions about people being called Al-Anon. If you want to watch the hair on my neck stand up, let me be in the room when some new drunk walks in. And somebody said, oh, look, there's Fred, the new alcoholic, and there's Rachel, his little Al-Anon wife, twitching in behind me. Because we do tend to get here with a twitch. And the only reason they're calling her Al-Anon is because she's twitching in behind him. She is not an Al-Anon, she's an alligator. Snappy little people. Al-Anon is not a program for people who need it. Statistics are, for every alcoholic, there is 1 to 4 people profoundly affected. There are 10 to 42 people directly affected by each alcoholic. I don't know who that leaves on the planet, personally. I don't. But it's hard to come to Al-Anon. I know, I know. It's hard to come to AA. I know. I've heard all the stories. Oh, Katie, you're late. Yeah, but this time you showed up, Katie. This time you showed up, and I'm very pleased with that. Thank you. No. You'll be sorry. I love her. She wears me flat ass out, but I love her. I was exhausted last time. Anyway. Where were we? Oh, yeah. I don't know what happens 5 to 10, but I'm pretty sure it's not good. Al-Anon is, it's hard to come to AA. That's what I was telling you. And I know. I've shoved a couple of them through the door myself, but I couldn't make them stick, you know. It's harder to come to Al-Anon. It's damn near impossible to come and ask for help when there's nothing the matter with you. Really, we're the program of it's not that bad. It's not that bad. It's not that bad. We get newcomers at just about every one of my committee meetings. We have newcomers at just about every meeting because there's so many people affected. But they are people who are not looking for recovery. They're looking for relief. They are in so much pain. And they are watching the people they love die. And they are powerless to do anything about it. And they may or may not by that time have developed some physical illnesses of their own, but it'll come. They say, well, you know what happens is you come in and you sit around the table and you listen to some solution, you read some of the literature, you talk to some people, and pretty soon you're feeling a little better. And that's when they start with, it's not that bad. I'll just get... I there's something on TV tonight. I'm just gonna stay home tonight, and then they're not there anymore. Sometimes Al-Anon's not a program for people who want it because they come and they say that, you know, boy, what you have is great, and I would really like to. Tired though. Gotta go. His clothes need washing. You know. Sometimes the laughter draws them into Al-Anon, and sometimes the laughter repels them, because alcoholism is not funny. It is a deadly disease. It kills the people who have it, and it kills the people who love them. You know who uses insurance first in an alcoholic home? The non-alcoholic. Alcoholics have blessed moments of blackout. We don't. No, we're awake and paying attention. Some of us are taking notes. You know, my first year in Al-Anon, I started to see that maybe, just maybe, my obsession with his drinking was the issue. And I would say to him, "You haven't been." He would come home and I'd say, "I haven't seen you since Wednesday," and it's Sunday. And he'd go, "No, I was here Friday night." "You were?" So I started keeping a notebook. I would keep hash marks. But it was Al-Anon, so it was in colors, and there were several. What time he came home, what day he came home, what condition he was in, you know, when he got home. So I could start to lose the twitch, you know. If you hear us, I can't imagine, but if somebody was talking about it, if you see people who are not laughing, if you hear us laughing about stuff you don't think is funny, keep coming back. You can't laugh about something that hasn't been healed. But if it's been healed for one of us, it can be healed for all of us. Keep coming back. Al-Anon is really only a program for people who are willing to work at it, because that's what it requires. Persistent, ongoing effort. It is a program of action. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a 12-step recovery program that I practice like my life depends on it. I'm convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a sponsor, and she knows she's my sponsor. And she seems to love me more the more flawed I appear to be. And I've never told her anything that surprised her. I never told her anything that made her go, "You did what?" Like my mother used to do that. God, the long-suffering mother. Oh. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a committed meeting that I go to like a doctor's appointment. If you want to find me, you come Monday night at 6:15 to the Addison Al-Anon Family Group meeting in Addison, Texas, and that's where I'll be. And when I walk in that room, they go, "Oh, Alan, there you are." Now, sometimes they do it with their eyes. But I still have my mind-reading abilities. So I can still pick that up. It's a place I'm welcomed. It's a place I belong. I noticed, not in the last several years maybe, that that's the way I behave at that meeting. I go into that meeting with my arms open, going, "Alyssa, there you are. There you are. I am so glad to see you." I sat in that meeting one night, and there was a gal in there that I sponsored. And she's just the dearest thing on the planet. And she had had such a torturous 2 years. I mean, she really was living on a thin line. She was just miserable, trying as hard as any human could try. And I looked over at her and I realized I loved her more than I am capable of loving a human being. I wasn't doing that. I was being loved through. That is such a gift. Such a gift. And I thought, anybody else in the room? No. It's sort of a muscle you have to work with. I'm an Al-Anon, and I'm so grateful there is such a thing as Al-Anon to be. When I was 17, Mama diagnosed me. She diagnosed me as boy crazy. The place she sent me to be safe was Lubbock, Texas. Lubbock, Texas is where the very first Al-Anon meeting in the entire state of Texas was held. Because Lubbock, Texas is in the middle of a dry area. You know, dry areas where they tell alcoholics they can't drink. Nothing makes them drink faster and tell them they can't. Well, she sent me there for an education. I went looking for him, but I was always looking for him. Now, I always had a him, because you couldn't be himless. But I mean, you can't be sure that this one is the best. I mean, look who he's with. So I was always looking for him. And it took me 6 months, but after 6 months, I found him. Oh, he was married to somebody else and had two kids and was 60 pounds overweight. But none of that seemed insurmountable to me. I personally have never liked the easy ones. You know, the ones who go, "Oh, you're so cute. Can I?" "No, get away from me. I want to work for. Those ones you have to earn. Those ones you have to make love you. And then I would have my prize. Oh, lucky, lucky me. And then 3 weeks later, he's breathing. You know, I can hear the breathing. I'm like, was he always breathing like that? You know? Well, a year later, we had shed the wife, the 2 kids, and the 60 pounds, because I'm a total redoer when I redo them. And we got married. We were married 6 months when he hit me the first time. He was drunk when he hit me. He was drunk every time he hit me. Now, the reaction I had to that wasn't anything anybody taught me. There was no big people hitting each other in the family I grew up in. But I had a little moment of clarity, and I thought, I have got to let him know that that is not okay. So you know what I did? I double dog dared him to do it again. Seems like a power move at the moment. Slides right into that step 2 insanity thing right there. Didn't take any more insanity on his part to hit me the second time than it did the first time. And that's the way we live. Now, I can't tell you when this happens. I can tell you as a result of doing a lot of inventory and a lot of talking about it. A lot of talking about it. I was going to the grave with that. I wasn't going to tell anybody. Like nobody knew, you know. I was talking to a counselor a couple of years ago, and I was telling her that part of my life, and she said, do you know how flatly you said that? Do you have any idea how many times I've said that? Mm-hmm. The power is gone out of that. It's gone. I can't tell you when it happened, but I can tell you as a result of the inventories that the reason I didn't leave was every time he hit me, I believed what he said, which it was, if I hadn't done what I did, he wouldn't have to do what he did. Every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was, I deserved that. Every time he hit me and I got up the next morning and I looked at a black eye or a split lip or a bloody nose and I said to myself, it's not that bad. Every time I got up in the morning and I had to remember my little children, the looks on their faces, and I said to myself, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. I'll just stay home a couple of days until it all clears up and nobody will. Every time I did that, a piece of me left and another piece and another piece and another piece until 9 years later, there was nobody left who could stand up and say, you can't treat me like that, because I stayed married to him 9.5 years. I'm a sticker. I will make my bed and I will damn near die in it. The reason I left him, I know you're going to be surprised. There was another man. And he said the magic words. He said, I love you. You don't have to live like that anymore, and I love you. Now, that was immediately following a scene at the lake where my husband held me repeatedly under a cabin cruiser in 20 feet of water. When I told my first sponsor what he had done, what I called hitting, she said, honey, it isn't hitting. That's attempted murder. But I had that disease called, it's not that bad. It can't be that bad. And this guy came along and said, you don't have to live like that, and I love you. Oh, don't need you, got this one. Now, when I came to Al-Anon, it seems to me that it's pretty much the way we are in Al-Anon. We tend to come in with one of two feelings. We come in angry or we come in hurt. If you come in angry, you're going to have to learn to deal with the hurt. If you come in hurt, you're going to have to learn to deal with the anger. It's the same feeling. It's just whether I'm blowing it out on you or sucking it in on me. When I came in, I hurt. Everything hurt. The only feeling I had left was hurt. So my sponsor made me get one of those magnetic things with the faces on it, you know, the drawings, the caricatures that go, you know, it says, it has this, and underneath it'll go, surprised. So then you look in the mirror, and if you're going like that, you are surprised. Yay! The only place you could put it, of course, was on the refrigerator. It was the only place big enough to hold the magnet. So I'd be talking to her on the phone, telling her what was happening. She'd go, how do you feel? And I'd go, I don't know. She'd say, go to the refrigerator. Which is really not a good way to get in touch with your feelings. I'm just saying, go to the refrigerator. Whole another 12-step program. One day I came up with a new feeling and I knew she'd be pleased. People pleasing, one of my worst defects, saved my life. Saved my life. Denial, one of my biggest defects, kept me alive long enough to get to you. But I wanted to please her. I could hardly tell her I had this new feeling. I called her up. I had a new feeling. She said, "Fabulous. What is it?" And I said, "Fear." She said, "Oh, what are you afraid of?" And I said, "Is that necessary? You really need to know, like, exactly what you're afraid of?" I'm just realizing I'm afraid all the time. All the time. Now, my sponsor believed that you should chase every fear to its root cause, because she said it's never what it looks like it is. There's something under there. There's something under there. So this sounds like it should have taken as long as it takes me to tell you, and I'm going to tell you, it probably took days, if not weeks. So this is what happened. She said, "Okay, what are you afraid of?" And I said, "Oh, well, I'm afraid he's going to leave me." She said, "Why?" "Well, he says he's going to leave me." She said, "Really? When is he going?" And I said, "Friday." He said he's leaving Friday. She said, "Sweetheart, let me tell you something. The best way to tell whether or not an alcoholic is leaving you is if he's gone." She taught me about turn off the sound, look at the picture. The sound will confuse you. They mean well, but they can't do it. And don't try to read their lips. That is even more confusing. Sing in your head if you have to, but just watch their feet. That's the thing. She said, "Okay, let's say he leaves you. Okay, now he's left me." And she said, "What are you afraid of now?" "Now I'm afraid that I'm alone. Because I've avoided being alone my entire life. I'm terrified of being alone. Because if I'm alone, I'm going to have to deal with this thing that I have avoided. The biggest thing in my life that I've avoided forever, which is I am permanently flawed. There's something the matter with me that's not the matter with anybody else. I am not enough. I'm not smart enough, old enough, young enough, rich enough, thin enough, whatever. I am not enough. And if I have to be left alone with and get into this not enough, what's going to happen is I'm not even going to be able to take care of myself. I will die." And there was, back in the day, I can't believe you people have fans back there. Really? Anyway, back in the day, there was another fear underneath that one that says that there is no God. And when somebody said, "I love you," to me, what I heard was, "I won't leave you." So when this one said, "I love you," and now, I made a little list in my head because I knew what I'd done wrong the first time. Ugh, not picking that again. A little checklist. This guy, perfect. He was the right age. He was the right height. Had the right job. Well, it wasn't exactly perfect, but it was okay. It wasn't that bad. And he had a steady income. And he had a nice family. And he was just darling. That's the kiss of death, if I love them. They're more than likely, if they don't have a chip, they need one, you know. He did have one tiny little flaw. He didn't come home nights. But I'm thinking a couple of home-cooked meals and some, you know, and I got them. That's the way I marked my territory back in the day. Yeah. My sisters. Then came menopause. Really, who cares? Mike, right? So much energy. So anyway, we rocked on like that for however long. And then one day this lady called where I worked and blah, 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 blah. She was crying on the phone. Now, I'm an alligator. If you want to see the alarms go off for an alligator, put us around somebody who's crying. The primary alligator illusion is when you're okay, then I'll be okay. And I have to do everything in my power to make you okay. Looks very loving and kind on the outside. It's the most self-centered behavior on the planet. I don't do it because I care about you. I do it because I need a reaction back from you that's going to make me okay. And if I don't get it, I will do insane things. I will lie and I will cheat and I will steal. And she started crying on the phone. Now, we have a deal at my Al-Anon group. We must have 8 boxes of Kleenex that sit around the table. They are, of course, in keeping with the season, because it is an Al-Anon room. And one day we came into her, and that Kleenex started disappearing from the room. We're like, what's happening? We haven't seen anybody cry that much. Where's the Kleenex going in? And so one day, well, someone said, I know. And you could hear this. She stomped into the AA room. Damn it, there were our Kleenexes in there. Always taking our stuff. So one well-meaning Al-Anon said, we'll just write our name on the boxes. Like they're reading the boxes. Kleenexes are all in the other room. So we had a group conscience meeting. Of course we did. And we just loved that. You know what we decided? We decided to buy twice as many Kleenex. We just gave them here. We love to know that you're crying. Anyway, we have a deal in my room, and we say when somebody is crying, do not shove the Kleenex at them. Let them reach for their recovery. Let them do it. We don't tell people if you could just stop crying, you could come back to another meeting. Or if you could get a little better attitude, we might let you share. We just love you just like you are. And if you want to cry and snot up the table, fine. That table has been snotted on so many times. We clean it once a month, but, I don't like to put anything up there just in case. So anyway, this woman called crying, and she told me this, her sad story, and her sad story included the fact that her husband was in treatment for alcoholism, and they were going to pay us back the money they owed us. It was just going to take them a while, blah, blah, blah. And I went, oh, I understand. Now, here comes the lie. My husband drinks too much, too. The problem was not his drinking. The problem was his behavior. He wasn't coming home. But I wasn't going to tell her he wasn't coming home, because I thought that was about me. I thought everything was about me. But I thought if I was a better wife, if I fixed better meals, if the kids were quieter, the house was cleaner, or something, if I moved the TV 3 inches over that way, maybe that'll do it. And maybe then he'll come home. I wasn't going to tell her that, because that's part of my flaw. I can't even get my husband to come home at night. And I didn't know I was talking to somebody new in Al-Anon. We're deadly when we're new. And we have a lot of answers. Don't know the questions. Got a lot of answers. And we're often accused of the Al-Anon waltz, 1-2-12, 1-2-12. I know what the problem is. I've heard about the answer. Let me tell you. Anyway, she took 6 months. Really, it took 6 months before I was willing to go to a meeting. And the only reason I was willing to go to the meeting was because I ended up in a doctor's office and I'd reached the point where all I could do was cry. I cried all the time. Deciding what shoes to put on the morning was a major decision. And the doctor knew my family and he said, I don't have your answers and the only people who might have them are Al-Anons. Do you know any? Yeah. She called the next morning. How do they know? How's it working for you? That kind of Dr. Phil thing. And I said, okay. I felt like, ugh. Really, it was surrender. It was surrender with a white flag, the whole thing. I felt like I was coming out of the jungle with my flag up. Okay, I give. She took me to meetings. She took me to meetings where I landed in a hotbed of Al-Anon. I had no idea how lucky I was to be with those people. I thought the first step in the program was get in the car. They say, so-and-so is going to do the steps across town on Wednesday night this month, and we're all going to go, we'll come by and pick you up, get in the car. After a while, I said, and I'm people-pleasing. I want to make them happy. Sure, I'll be there. Yeah, I'll be right out in front. Yeah, you won't have to wait or anything. I'll be right there. After a couple of months, I said to my sponsor, I said, I'm leaving my children home a lot by themselves. And she said, in your condition, that's probably a good thing. Well, blah, 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 blah. 1984. You're thinking, oh no, that was so long ago. I'll hurry. January of 1984, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Cancer is prevalent in alcoholic homes. I look around my group sometimes, and you know, in 30 people, there'll be 10 of us, 8 or 9 or 10 of us in the room who've had some form of cancer. And I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was 38, too young to have breast cancer. Both my children were adopted, so never birthing a child was one of the reasons on the checklist that I would be susceptible to breast cancer. The only other one was that I was female, because apparently quantity, I don't know, men get breast cancer too? Okay. I'm going to get this as quick as I can. So they gave me a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. I had a mastectomy, and I went through chemo, and this is 1984. We are talking caveman days with cancer and treatment. And I'm living in active alcoholism. He's still drinking. I would get violently ill with the chemo. Violently ill. After I had my first chemo treatment, she called, the nurse called the next morning to see how I was, and I had thrown up for 12 solid hours. And I said, you know, I could do anything for 12 hours. It would appall me if I had to keep it up for a lifetime. We have a Just for Today bookmark or pamphlet. We have it in everything you might possibly want. And the first one, the number one thing on there is, I can do anything for 12 hours. It would appall me if I had to keep it up for a lifetime. And that was what I said to her. And she's like, you could almost hear her go, say, what? Al-Anon and AA, because part of the regimen for me in the early 1980s, was I went to 2 Al-Anon meetings and an open AA meeting every week. I am so grateful that I got to go to those AA meetings. You know, when the Alcoholics I Love talk, all I can hear is my own pain. But when there's an alcoholic up there talking that I'm not emotionally involved with it, there are very few of those. Anyway, I started to be able to see where the disease stopped and the person started. I started to understand the difference between can't and won't, you know. And, I'm so sorry, Lee. You're just going to have to deal with me, darling. Marcy White in Lake Whitney, Texas, was my sponsor for 15 years before she died. Marcy White came to program in 1954 in Odessa, Texas, when there was no Al-Anon to come into. But her husband got sober, and she walked into the rooms of AA with her husband, and she was in love. She wanted what you had, and she was willing to go to any length to get it. And the AA women who have literally saved my life, and they saved her life, they said, sure, come on, we'll take you through the steps. And they took her through the steps in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's what we had. So when I went through the steps, I went through the Big Book because that's what Marcy got and that's what she gave me. I'm a Big Book Al-Anon. Now, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you may or may not know, is not conference-approved literature in Al-Anon. I know. Just saying. I'm just saying, but you can read my mind, can't you? Like, it's sort of stupid to try to do them without the directions. I don't know. Anyway, I hung my life on a couple of lines out of the Big Book, and one of them was, nothing but nothing happens by accident in God's world. It's not in the first 164 pages, but it'll work for me. And the other one was the last column of four-step inventory, which I read as, what was your part? Now, if I'd seen the mistake word, never would have done it. Never. I was constitutionally opposed to making mistakes. No, sir. But my part. Okay, well, let's slip into it that way. Let's just see. And I went through the steps that spring because I had I was convinced that this was a design for living that I wanted. And I wanted to know what my part was in the alcoholism, in the cancer, because I knew that I had a part in everything that happened. There weren't some places where I was helpless victim, and other places I had a part. I had a part in everything that happened. And what I discovered was the part I had in cancer was, I'm living in active alcoholism. I'm living in insanity. And I don't have the spiritual program to be able to do it. We say at Al-Anon, in the opening, they say, living with an alcoholic was too much for most of us. I will sometimes, if I know there's no newcomer in the room, I'll go, like, which of you was it not too much for? Could you just stand up and tell us and we'll all go home? It's too much for all of us. So here's my life being threatened one more time. I'm a sticker and I will stay until my life is threatened. You had treated me like my life had value. You had treated me like the second step, like I was being restored. Restored is what you do to something of value. It doesn't say beat back into shape, or drag it around behind a truck so it doesn't look like it did before or whatever. It's something of value. And I said, and I'd lost a breast, I'd lost all my hair. But the hardest thing I lost that year was him, because I said, if you can't stay sober, you can't stay here. I can't live in this. And if you ask him why, because he left, and if you ask him why I left, he would tell you it was that crazy daughter of mine, and anybody who had to live with her would drink too. Now, she didn't make me drink. She made me want to commit homicide. But she did not make me drink. She was crazy. I knew she was crazy. Everybody knew she was crazy. Something bad happened in the 8th grade, which was the year I was going through chemotherapy and cancer. She went from Little Miss Navy Blue and Beige to hot pink and neon orange over the side of the planet. Because that was the spring she started drinking and using, 8th grade. But I know that. I just thought she was crazy. And I thought it was an Al-Anon disease. No sign she'd ever get any help with that. But she, life got harder and harder for her and me, consequently. And I had to put her in a different school because she couldn't stay. She burned all the bridges where she was, put her in another school. They had her about 2 weeks, and they said, you know what, we're going to send her we're going to send her for an evaluation. She was 17. And I said, 2 days later, the guy calls from the treatment center, and he says, you know what, we do believe your daughter is alcoholic. And I said, I love them. And I can make her do stuff. She's 17. So, I thought if she was Al-Anon, there was no sign of hope. But if she was alcoholic, there was definitely something I could do. It's all about what I can do. And I'm going to tell you that there are rules in Al-Anon, suggestions in Al-Anon about you don't enable your children, blah, 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 blah. We don't enable anybody but ourselves. We do stuff for our kids because we're afraid of how we'll feel if that bad thing happens to them. So we are enabling ourselves. There is a thing, though, that I've learned in Al-Anon that mothers have to do everything they can think of for their children. They have to do everything they can think of for their children before we can let go. So I took her to an outpatient treatment center, and she got sober. It was fabulous. It was my fault, though, that she was an alcoholic. She let me know in no uncertain terms that was the reason. And truthfully, I didn't care. She could blame it anywhere she wanted to blame it. So she stayed sober about a year and a half, and then she started hanging out in slippery places with slippery people, and it feels like one more time my life is going to be threatened. If she starts drinking again, I'm back in active alcoholism, and I'll die. That's how it felt. So here was another thing I'd said a thousand times, but meant it for the first time. If you can't follow the rules of the house, you can't stay here. I did not want to kick my daughter out. Adore my daughter. I wanted her happy, healthy, home, and whole, and she couldn't do any of that. And so the day came, and I changed the locks on the house, but I planned the day to be the day I was going to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends, because I was going to need a lot of support. And as I'm packing my car to go, she threw herself across my bed, and she said, Mom, you're going to be a grandma. Now, she thought that was a cute way to tell me. I thought she was making... me the responsible party one more time. And we went through a couple of unpleasant, I don't like to think it was hours, but it might have been, before I picked up the phone and I called my sponsor and I turned myself in. She said, "Do you want her to stay?" I said, "No, and I feel so badly. My 18-year-old daughter is pregnant, and I don't want her to stay." She said, "Honey, there are only so many bad feelings in every relationship. Those are hers. Let her have them. And I'll stay on the phone while you tell her." I can see the phone lying on my bed. And you know what happened? I quit hurting. I thought the pain was about kicking her out. The pain is never in release. The pain is always in the holding on when it's time to let go. And it was time to let go of her and let her do and be what she needed to do and be. And she ended up, you know, we went around, we had a tough fall. She went around telling people what a bad mother I was, that she was pregnant and I wouldn't let her live at home. And I went around telling people, you know, "Now she's pregnant at me." It's all about me, you know, still. And I talked to a paper, and I said, "Buddy, she's pregnant at me." And I was serious. God loved them. He was serious right back with me, and he said, "Honey, I know exactly how you feel." But he said, "You know what? Our son's girlfriend had a baby out of wedlock, and that child has been the light of our lives." You know, I've loved babies my whole life. God was off. I think sometimes the sanity in step two may be nothing short of paradise. But the reason we don't get paradise is, "Yeah, but not today, God, not me, God, not my child, God, not like this, not like this." I'm telling God how to run the planet, the universe. My journey in Al-Anon has been from yeah, but to thank you. And that was such an old idea about how babies ought to come into the world and who ought to have them. And I decided to say, "Thank you for the baby. Thank you for the baby." Every choice, every decision I have, pretty much every decision I have to make is a choice between a grievance or a miracle. And I decided to say yes to the miracle of a new baby. And a couple of months later, she called. She still wasn't going to live with me. And I called. She called a couple of months later. She said, "Mom, I know you're knitting a blue blanket. Knit faster. It's twin boys." You know, alcoholics. If one's good, I'll just have another. Well, a couple of things happened. She still couldn't live with me. But I did tell her that once the babies were born, she didn't like dolls. And I wasn't sure. I was really worried about the babies. And I said, "I'm not going to have any peace of mind not knowing where you are and where those babies are." And I said, "So for my peace of mind, you may come and live with me with those babies until I know that I can let you go." Well, she's perfectly happy. So she came, and a 4.0-pound baby boy and a 5.3-pound baby boy came into my life. And that second baby has made all the difference. They were born March 5th of 1988. We're moving. And when they were 5 weeks old, she said, "Mom, hey, I'm not going to keep them. You can have them if you want them, but I got to go." She knew she was getting ready to drink and use again. And she did not want to be there with them. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that they didn't have to, you know, we didn't have to do that. But nonetheless, she picked up and left and left me with my son, who was, that was the summer before his senior year. And we got two babies. And I got a job that doesn't have money in it for two babies, you know. My son and I sometimes say, "How did we do that? How did we do that?" I would come home from work and I'd sit on cross-legged on my bed with one in the crook of this leg and the other one. That's the way I fed them. But like that. Anyway, that was such a thing. Do you want them, or do you want them? Shall we give them up for adoption? What should we do? My sponsor always told me that God wanted for me what I wanted for me in my heart of hearts. But I'm so afraid to make a decision. What if I pick the wrong thing? what if I pick this week, and then next week something better comes and I can't have it because I picked the stupid thing last week. So I just don't make decisions. I let other people make them and then get all upset, you know. It doesn't work out. So my sponsor kept saying, write about it. Tell me, figure out what you want. And she said, oh, honey, one more time. She said, God, you know, God isn't a terrorist waiting around the corner to test your patience. God really wants you happy, joyous, and free. Your job is walking in the direction of your dreams. But where you get is God's deal. And God's promise to you is this or something better. Always. God's desire in you to express perfectly through you is so great that you never completely reap the harvest of errors, and you always reap more than you sow of good. And I wanted to be the grandmother. I didn't want to be the mom. They're the children of two addicts, and I'm done raising addicts. Please, God, hear me. Please, God. So I went to adoption agencies. I put the babies through a genetic study because there was something very obviously different about the littler baby. And I wanted whoever got them to know everything there was to know about them. I didn't want somebody to get them and go, ooh, I don't want this one, you know. A couple adoption agencies said we'd have to split them. And I knew there was a line right there. No, they'll stay with me before they'll get split. That won't happen. That won't happen. And we found a place that... not only we put them in the same home, they let me pick the surrender date. They let them stay with me. They didn't have to go to foster care from me and then into another home. They were 5 months old when they finally went to their new family. And the day I picked to be the surrender date was on my way to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends because I knew I'd cry for the week. I cried for the year. Oh, my gosh. Al-Anon's fall in love. I fell in, I mean, the way we love you is not natural. It's just not. We love you from somewhere above your head to somewhere below your feet, you know, and where you walk is hallowed ground, and I'd fallen in love with heartbeats in a hospital before those babies were born. Well, the people who adopted them let us stay family. We saw them every month. We had a meal with them. They came to my house for Christmas. They came for Easter. When they were 9 and 10 and 11, they let them come and spend 3 or 4 days with me. Oh, just me and my boys, you know. They went to live with a family in a small town where my daughter thought they'd be safe from alcoholism. And they'd never been on an escalator. I'll never forget the first time when I put them on it. They were like, whoa. All they wanted to do was down and up, down and up, down and up, down and up. Of course, the little one wanted to go up the down. And things were, you know, things went pretty well until they entered high school, and then it started getting not so good. These people did not believe in the disease of alcoholism. They had done no investigation. They had no idea what was going to happen. And the boys told me, they said, you know, we didn't drink. There wasn't alcohol, that much alcohol available where we were. But he said, they told me that when they graduated from high school that night, that was the night they started drinking. And this was maybe a year and a half later, they were telling me that. And one of them said, you know what the big deal is? Because he was living on his own. And he said, I had a refrigerator, beer in my refrigerator, and they couldn't leave it. He was 20. By the time he was 23, he was in prison. He had 5 alcohol-related infractions. One of them was walking drunk in downtown Dallas. Hello, how drunk do you have to be to get... Anyway, now there's some parts of my life since then that aren't funny, so I'm just going to warn you, they're coming. The little twin, Cameron, the one who made all the difference. In October of 2013, Cameron killed himself driving drunk in a one-vehicle accident. And the father those people were just devastated, devastated. And he kept saying, but he'd drive to the scene of the accident. He'd say, what did he hit? What killed him? What? And the police would say, speed and alcohol, sir, speed and alcohol. That's what it is, speed and alcohol. they've had a horrible time. I mean, physically, they are just done in with that. Anthony, the oldest one. Oh, you'd love him. You would love him. He's beautiful to look at. Oh, so slick and cool. Oh, so alcoholic. Knowing that his brother died drunk, he got one more DWI right after his brother killed himself. And I don't know how many thousands of dollars he paid his attorney to keep it in the courts and not get sent away to prison until last September. And last September, locked him up. He's still there. They kept him in county jail for a couple of months till a bed opened up in one of the judicial treatment centers. We have a bunch of them in Texas. And they sent him to a judicial treatment center. Well, they will talk to them about the disease of alcoholism. I hope there's AA in there because he's got it. I just hope he can catch it quick enough. You know what I mean? And I got a letter from him. The first letter I got from him in jail, it's 6 pages, front and back. Got nothing else to do, you know. So. And he said, God, Grandma, he said, you know, they tell you, when you're growing up, they say drugs and alcohol will kill you, but they don't tell you first it's going to be a lot of fun. They don't tell you that. And he said, I'm figuring out about addiction here. And he said, well, I understand there can be some real serious legal and financial repercussions if you keep drinking. And he said, I am so glad I didn't drink long enough. Did you see the return address on your envelope? State Criminal Justice Department? Jail? God, love him. Well, June 12th, he comes out of the treatment center, and because his judge said that he was going to get some grime under his fingers, she sent him to the Salvation Army halfway house. I love it. What? So, my daughter stayed sober about, she started drinking, I don't remember how long it was, but at some point, at January 29th of 1990, she walked back into AA, and I didn't have anything to do with it. You had everything to do with it, because you didn't treat her like she was too young to be alcoholic, or because she did drugs, it somehow negated her alcoholism, and she walked back into AA, and she had 20 years of a fabulous sobriety. She helped a lot of people and had more fun. She called me one day and she said, oh, Mom, it's the best day of my life. She was in an all-day workshop with Scott Redmond in the steps, and she said, this is the best day of my life. Best day. Melissa killed herself this last January. And I can't tell you where she slipped. I can only tell you where she fell. And she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2008. Too young, but she had it nonetheless. And the doctor kept saying, you sure you're not blood-related? No. And pain pills. Now, I have nothing against pain pills, except she wouldn't let somebody else dispense them. She insisted on doing her own dispensing. And between that and my grandson's ADD pills and her antidepressants and blah, 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 her life just went to hell in a handbasket. She tried desperately to get sober again and again and again. And she came to meetings and she sat with you and you loved her. She was here at Girls Talk. Maybe 3 years ago she was here. Somebody paid her way and she came. She came home on fire. She could not stay sober. And when she died, she tried taking, when Cameron died, she tried to overdose with every pill she had. Her drug tolerance is very high. Her pain tolerance is very low. And she couldn't take enough pills. She knocked herself out for 36 hours, but she didn't die. And when she died in January, there were gallons of alcohol in that car. And you could see that she tried that and that didn't work. So she resorted to violence. her boys, she has two more boys who are 19 and 17, and they've been living with me and my husband for 4 years now because it got so bad, I just couldn't leave them there. I couldn't leave them there. And I kept thinking, you know, it'll get better, it'll get better. And they would say, you know, for a while they said, you know, when are we going home? And I'd say, well, you know, but by now they've been with me long enough that that's home. And we saw less and less and less of her. She got, something happened, and I don't know what happened, because she would not talk about it. She didn't have a job, she didn't have any insurance, she didn't have any anything. She was alone. She was not unloved. She was not unloved. But she was alone. And apparently the day before she'd gotten a call from the doctor's office and the cancer was back. And it was, she was given months and she would have to go on chemo. And she was having none of it. None of it. Because my husband was diagnosed last October with leukemia and he was dying. And my daughter, I know, was thinking, I can't, Mom can't watch us both. She just can't. And I just got to get out of here. I know she did. 3 weeks after she died, my husband died. Yeah, you know, it's not a veil of tears, I'm here to tell you, though. It's not a veil of tears. Where her death was a tragedy, my daughter was not a tragedy. She was not. She has dear friends who I hear from on a daily basis who have loved her and tried. And we were getting ready for service and we were texting back and forth. There were like four of them and I'm texting back and forth. And they were, I said, you all are just so wonderful. I may have to have you come to my house for Thanksgiving this year with the rest of the family. And they all went, I'll be there, I'll be there, I'll be there. And I texted them back and I said, oh, that just makes me so teary. What they read was autocorrect, which said, that makes me so testy. Sorry, Charlie. I need to stop, don't I? You're done. Okay. I gotta tell you about this second, my husband who just died. I kissed a lot of frogs to get to the prince. We were married just about 25 years. He was not alcoholic when I married him. Only took him 2 years to catch it. October 15th of 1994, he said, I'm an alcoholic. And he was 22 years sober when he died. In the fall, when he got that diagnosis and we realized it was just a matter of months, he said, you know, I've had a wonderful life. And he said, the last 22 years have been better than anything I deserved. I couldn't take him home because I wanted to leave him in hospice because I wasn't the only one who loved him. And there were people who wanted to be with him. And they were with him 24/7 in hospice. When he died, I knew he was dying, and I could feel his hand in my back pushing me out of the room. He did not want me there when it happened. But when he died, there was someone in that room from all three 12-step programs he was in. We have a program, we have a design for living, and you know what I've discovered? I'm going to tell you this, and then I'm going to stop. I've discovered three wonderful things so far. My prayers have to be for today. They can't be for any further than today. I've discovered that death is as much a part of marriage as the wedding vows, whether the death is the death of the relationship or the death of the person. I am so grateful that I got to be my daughter's mother her whole life. I didn't miss any. I am so grateful that this precious man, we both thought we married above ourselves. That was good. That Al-Anon allowed me to love again. And I could love him with all my heart and soul. I have no regrets. I'm so grateful for the years we had together. And he is not lost, and she is not lost. I know right where they are. Sometimes I'm holding hands, sometimes Melissa's in front of me and he's behind me, but they're not lost. The other thing I've learned is I have to let go of what goes. Divine restoration, the hope of step two, is happening right here, right now. Divine fulfillment, which is the promise of step 12, is happening right here, right now. And because of you, I have a God who's so big that I already know I love what comes. Whatever comes, I will love it. I used to think that when I died and went to heaven, God was going to say, pull out the VCR and the tape and let me see how her husband and her family turned out. And if they have turned out to be fine, upstanding members of the community, she's earned her way into heaven and she can come in. I'm so grateful you let me find another God. I don't know what's going to happen at the end for me. Really, I don't. But I suspect when that part of me, when my body gets tired of doing whatever it is we're doing here, and that part of me that's always been God goes to where God is. When I get there, God's going to go, oh, Ellen, there you are. Oh. He's going to say, you know what, precious? Heaven's heaven when you're not here, but it's just not perfect without you. And then he's going to say, you know what? He said, I've been running a little experiment. It really isn't a test. You couldn't fail it. It's just an experiment down there. And I know you've been paying close attention. So I'd like your opinion on how it's going. Maybe in your heaven, God will want your opinion. But in mine, he may still be busy with me. You don't know. First thing he's going to say is, did you have a good time? Did you have a good time? Golly days. Because of you, I'm going to be able to say, oh, yes, God. I had a great time at your party. Thanks for asking me. And the second thing he's going to say is, were you Ellen? You know, you're the only one like that I made. I had things for you to do that nobody else could do because my hands are too big and my voice is too loud. Were you Ellen? That scared me because I spent so much of my life trying to be what I thought other people wanted me to be. I didn't know if I'd been me. So in my written inventory at night for a couple of years, I wrote today, Ellen. And I wrote down whatever one thing I did that day that I knew when I was doing it was mine to do. This was mine to do. You could have had another speaker and been at lunch. That's not what happened to you. When you listen to the CD, you're going to go, wow, there's a lot missing. Yeah, there really is. But you were here. You were here. The rest of them will just be sorry. And the last thing he's going to say is, honey, did you ever get the joke? I got the joke the year of cancer. I got the joke standing at the back door with a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. I got the joke standing there with no hair on my body. Anywhere. I had like 6 gray hairs, but that's all I had. And they were like nerve endings that kind of blew around. I wasn't going to cut them. They were all the hair I had. But I would wear a little hat so I wouldn't offend you with my nerve endings up there. And I had a husband that I loved dearly who would say, what's for dinner? And he might not come home for a week. And I had a hot pink neon orange daughter who was living over the edge of the planet. And I had a beige navy blue boy who was sleeping more during the day and awake more at night, disappearing. And I thought I'd go out and buy a little plant to plant in my yard. And I looked down and realized I was going to have to go back and shave my legs. All the hair except on my legs. I laughed till I cried. I could hear God rolling around the floor of heaven, you know. It's one of those Bethesda things. One of those leaves in my pool kind of problems, you know. I realize that I've spent so much of my life thinking I have to get something so I'll be okay. Or thinking I have to hold on to something so I'll be okay. I almost missed the truth, which is right now, right here, I'm okay. Wherever the now is, if I'm here in it, I'm okay. I've never gotten to a moment in my life when I didn't have everything I needed to deal with this moment. Even if what I have is the ability to hold my hand and say, help, I got it when I need it. And that's where my life is right now. I almost missed my life. I almost missed my life. Thank you. Thank you. There's a guy in my group that says the glass isn't half full or half empty. The glass is just too damn big. The magic of what happens here is somehow when I stand up here and pour, somehow when I sit down, I'm the one whose glass overflows. And I thank you.
Thank you. Hold hands for you.